Good day and welcome to From the Middle East to the Midwest Fuels America conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Jeff Cooper. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, and welcome, and thanks again to everyone for joining the call this afternoon. If you happened to buy gas this weekend, as I did, you surely noticed that prices are again on the rise. Prices for regular-grade gasoline have jumped 25 to 30 cents per gallon nationwide over the past couple weeks, and we're seeing the highest gas prices that we've seen since early June. So, as usual, there's been lots of finger-pointing and accusation by the oil companies about the recent spike in gas prices, and that's why we thought it would be a good idea to hold this call this afternoon and share our views on what factors are and are not driving current gas prices. So today we're lucky to have a lineup of experts to share their perspectives on these issues, what's really happening with the global oil market and oil prices, as well as what's happening with renewable fuels. We're going to hear from Ann Koren with the Institute for Analysis of Global Security. Also with us, we have Bruce Volin, who owns and operates a gas station. And finally, we're going to hear from Anna Rath with NextStep, who is working on next-generation biofuels. I should also mention that the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee is holding a hearing on this subject tomorrow. And because of the recent turmoil in oil markets and the rise in gasoline prices, we expect that the hearing will get a fair amount of attention. And when you look at the lineup of witnesses tomorrow, it seems likely to us that there's going to be some attempts to divert attention away from the real causes of higher crude oil and gasoline prices. And we fully expect some of the witnesses tomorrow to try and blame biofuels and the renewable fuel standard and the so-called blend wall for the higher fuel prices that we're seeing. That, of course, is utterly ridiculous, and we want to spend some time this afternoon addressing some of the myths that you're likely to hear at tomorrow's hearing. You know, first and foremost, we want to make it clear that ethanol is reducing, not increasing, gas prices for consumers. And there's really been broad consensus around this fact. Several analyses over the last several years have estimated the impacts of increased ethanol blend on wholesale retail gasoline prices. And the results of those studies vary somewhat. They all indicate that using ethanol does, in fact, result in meaningful savings at the pump. These analyses have been conducted by economists from places like Merrill Lynch, Louisiana State University, the Department of Energy, University of Wisconsin, Iowa State University, and several others. And the estimates of the reduction in gasoline prices that is attributable to increased ethanol use have ranged from about 20 cents per energy equivalent gallon, and that number comes from a Department of Energy study in 2008, to over a dollar per gallon in 2012. And that estimate comes from a pair of economists at the University of Wisconsin and Iowa State University. Now, there are really at least three important dynamics that explain ethanol's ability to reduce gas prices at the pump. The first factor, and I think the one that is most often overlooked, is just the effect of fuel supply extension. On a cumulative basis, more than 75 billion gallons of ethanol have been added to the gasoline supply from 2005 to 2012, and today ethanol makes up 10% of the gasoline supply. It's a basic economic concept that when you increase the supply of substitutable goods, the price of those goods is going to decrease. And that's exactly what we've seen happen with gasoline prices because of the extending effect of ethanol. It's similar in ways if you think of the example of butter and margarine. Prices for butter are forced down when you add margarine, which is a cheaper substitute to that marketplace. So because of the emergence of ethanol, it's almost like the U.S. oil refining industry has found a way to extract 10% more gasoline from a barrel of oil. And this is a big factor. It's a hard one to quantify, a hard one to measure, but it's a tremendously important factor that ethanol has on gas prices. Secondly, and this one is a lot easier to see, ethanol is cheaper than gasoline at the wholesale level. Ethanol has consistently sold at a discount to gasoline blend stock at the wholesale level since 2007. The average since 2010 has been, you know, ethanol has been about 50 cents per gallon less expensive than gasoline on average during that time. And that wholesale spread between ethanol and gasoline has really served as a strong incentive for gasoline blenders and refiners to maximize their use of ethanol. The difference between ethanol and gasoline just on Friday was 67 cents per gallon, and that's the highest spread, the widest spread we've seen in over 3 months. So today we're seeing ethanol priced around $2.45 a gallon compared to gasoline at wholesale around $3.10 or $3.12 per gallon. So obviously blending less expensive ethanol with more expensive gasoline is going to result in lower prices for blended product at the pump. And then the third factor that we want to briefly mention is just the fact that ethanol is a far cheaper source of octane than the other sources of octane that are available. Ethanol is a very high octane fuel that is used ubiquitously by refiners and blenders to increase gasoline octane to the minimum levels required for sale. So using ethanol in lieu of other refinery octane enhancers has allowed refiners to reduce their use of energy-intensive processes at the refinery, and that has significantly reduced gasoline production costs. There's been a very recent analysis by the Department of Energy that's looked at ethanol's octane value, and what they found is that even if ethanol prices were 110% the price of wholesale gasoline prices, it would still be more economical for refiners to use ethanol for octane enhancement rather than producing octane at the refinery from petroleum processes. And we're nowhere near 110% the price of gasoline today. As I said, we're much closer to 80%. So I want to talk for just a minute or two about RINs before I turn the call over to the other speakers. We know that we're going to hear about RINs at tomorrow's hearing. And again, RINs are the numbered credits that are generated by biofuel producers and attached to each gallon of renewable fuel that is sold under the renewable fuel standard. So when an obligated party, which is typically an oil refiner, buys a gallon of renewable fuel, they also obtain that RIN credit with the gallon. And then the RIN is used by the obligated party to demonstrate that they complied with their obligation to blend renewable fuel. So RINs can be banked or traded by refiners, and that really enhances the flexibility of the RFS program. Some refiners, including one that will testify tomorrow at the hearing, have suggested that higher RIN prices driven by the arrival of what they call the E10 blend wall is the reason we're seeing higher gas prices. And there really isn't a shred of evidence to support that notion. The blend wall has actually been erected by the oil companies themselves, and it's really just another excuse for their refusal to move to higher level ethanol blends. You know, it's important to remember that when it comes to compliance with the RFS, oil companies have a choice. They can purchase a gallon of ethanol that comes with the RIN attached, and again, that's going for $2.45 a gallon today, or they can purchase a detached RIN from third parties or other oil companies who previously blended more ethanol than they were required to. So unfortunately, we're seeing some oil companies choosing to purchase those detached RINs and use those rather than increasing their use of ethanol. And this is occurring despite the existence of practical and economical options. You know, certainly E15 and E85 blends are legal. They've been approved by the Environmental Protection Agency, and they offer a workable pathway for meeting increased RFS requirements. We'd only need to see slight increases in E15 consumption this year and next year to satisfy RFS obligations with physical gallons of renewable fuel rather than using banked RINs. We're also, AAA is also on the agenda for the hearing tomorrow, and so we wanted to clear up a few things in advance of AAA's testimony. You know, they very likely will say that there aren't any automakers that guarantee the use of higher level RINs, and that just isn't correct. There are approximately 15 million flex fuel vehicles on the roadways today that are capable of using anything up to 85% ethanol. And about one-third of the new model year 2013 light-duty vehicles include explicit coverage of blends up to E15 in their warranty statements and owner's manuals. Most of those are being produced by General Motors and Ford. And in fact, we just learned this morning that Volkswagen will be including similar language in their owner manuals and warranty statements for next year's models, model year 14 vehicles. So by the end of 2013, there will be at least 20 million vehicles on the road that are unequivocally approved by the auto manufacturers themselves for E15 or E85 use, and that's almost 10% of the U.S. fleet. And also, we've pointed out in the past that EPA has approved the use of E15 in everything dating back to model year 2001, and that, you know, that includes about 85% of the vehicle miles traveled today. So the majority of the fleet is covered under EPA's E15 waiver. But the bottom line here is that there's really no data or analysis at all to support the idea that higher RIN prices are pushing gas prices higher. In fact, if you look at the data, it shows no correlation at all between prices for RINs and prices for gasoline. If you look at RIN prices and retail gas prices since February, what you actually see is an inverse relationship. Gas prices have fallen while RIN prices have risen and vice versa. We've done that analysis and would be happy to share it with anyone who's interested to see it. And on the same point, on this point of whether RINs influence gas prices or not, EIA's Administrator Adam Siminski, who is actually a witness at tomorrow's hearing, recently said, and I'm quoting here, "As far as we can tell, we can't really see any big impact in the price of gasoline from what has happened with RINs in the first quarter this year." So lots of people have looked at this, and they've all come to the same conclusion that there's just no, really no impact of what we're seeing with RINs on gas prices. In fact, we're seeing markets actually turn big oil switching RINs completely. What we're seeing is higher RIN prices are actually lower fuel prices for consumers. And I'm sure Bruce is going to address this somewhat. But what we're seeing is independent marketers and retailers who are buying ethanol, and again, it comes with a RIN. They're blending it to make E85. They're separating the RIN from the gallon and selling it to a refiner who has chosen to buy RINs rather than gallons. And so the sale of that RIN is allowing the retailer or marketer to reduce the price of E85 for the consumer. And we're seeing that happen all over. E85 is being priced, you know, a dollar or more per gallon below gasoline, and that really has created some new demand for E85, and we are seeing consumer demand pick up. There really isn't any good reliable data on a national basis regarding E85 sales, but we do have some good state data, and if you look at data from the state of Minnesota, we've seen E85 sales double in 1 month from April to May, as RINs have enabled this pricing at retail. I should also mention here that what we're seeing in the marketplace, you know, the idea that consumers want more renewable fuel is supported by the results of a recent national poll that was sponsored by Fuels America. And that poll showed that 75% of Americans want more renewable fuel options at the gas pump. And the results of that survey are available on the Fuels America website. So if the RFS and ethanol aren't driving fuel prices, and they are not, what is? I think the answer to that is pretty simple. It's oil. The cost of crude oil still accounts for about 2/3 of the price of gasoline, according to EIA, and the oil market is global in nature. We don't control it. All you have to do is look at what is going on in Egypt, and the unrest there is behind the recent surge in oil prices, and that in turn is what has driven gasoline prices here domestically. So, you know, I think what is going on in the Middle East is a perfect example of why we can't frack our way to energy security. Yes, we're producing more oil domestically, but the U.S. produces less than 10% of the world's crude oil, and we use, you know, more than 20%. So we will remain subject to the whims of the world market. And I know that's the subject that Ann is going to discuss, and we're lucky to have Ann with us today to expand on the factors that drive world crude oil prices. Ann is an energy expert from the Institute for Analysis of Global Security. And at this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Ann.
Thank you. You know, the big elephant in the room when it comes to oil prices and indeed to gas prices is OPEC. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the oil cartel. And this is a factor that's very often neglected in the dialogue about energy security in Washington. If you look at what has happened over the past 40 years, remember, in October, it'll be 40 years since the Arab oil embargo in 1973. If you look at what has happened over the past 40 years, then you realize that while the number of automobiles on the road has quadrupled, global population has almost doubled, global oil demand has increased drastically, OPEC, which sits on three-quarters of world conventional oil reserves, is producing almost exactly what it was producing 40 years ago. 40 years ago, OPEC produced 30 million barrels a day. Today, they're producing 30.4 million barrels a day. And this fundamentally is the reason that oil prices are very high. And especially if you look at what has happened over the past couple of years in the oil market, you see that the Arab Spring has had a very, very profound impact on what we call the fiscal break-even price of oil. This has nothing to do with the break-even price of oil for private companies. It has everything to do with the price of oil required to balance the budgets of OPEC regime, and specifically to balance the budgets of the pricing doves within OPEC, namely Saudi Arabia. Post-Arab Spring, nobody wanted to end up like Mubarak. If you look at the monarchs in the Gulf, they want to keep their heads attached to their necks, and so what they did is they funneled tremendous amounts of subsidy grants to their populations, drastically increased salaries to government employees. Of course, most of the subjects of these regimes work for the government. And so the budgetary expenditures of the regimes grew very substantially. Now, they want to balance the budget, unlike us, and so the income has to grow substantially as well. And since the primary source of income is energy sales, their choice is either sell more barrels at a lower price or sell fewer barrels at a higher price. And being a cartel, OPEC will always choose to sell fewer barrels at a higher price. The price of oil required to break even the budget of OPEC regimes has grown and grown and grown. And if you listen to what the petroleum ministers of the various OPEC countries say is the fair price of oil, then that gives you a good clue as to what that break-even price is. In the 90s, we were looking at $20 for what they call the fair price of oil. And today, we're looking at $90 to $100, and even more for certain OPEC countries. And it will simply go higher and higher. Now, we've been told in the U.S. by politicians on both sides of the aisle that if all we do is we drill more or conversely use less oil, if we reduce our imports, specifically from the Middle East, then that will reduce price at the pump. We've been told that over and over again, and it's simply a lie. This is the energy security paradox. It is not the case that increasing domestic supply of oil in the U.S. or even reducing demand through efficiency is going to drive down the price of oil. The reason is, of course, you just heard, we're in a global market. While we may increase supply domestically here, that doesn't mean that supply internationally increases. And indeed, what we've seen is while the U.S. has been drilling more, and you know that's a good thing that we're producing more oil, it's a good thing for people that live in those areas especially, at the end of the day, this has been offset by an increase in demand from the developing world, and it has not been matched by an increase in supply from the places where it's cheapest to lift and discover more oil, namely OPEC countries. And so you've seen that our imports of oil have fallen from in 2005, from some 60% of our oil demand was imported, and today we're at 36%, and yet prices have steadily increased. So reducing imports really does nothing to reduce the price of oil and the price of gasoline. And the other point to keep in mind is that never in our history did we import more than 15%, 1/5, of our demand from the Persian Gulf. What we're importing from the Persian Gulf is much more important than physical oil. What we are importing from the Persian Gulf is the price of oil. And that will be the case as long as oil is essentially the sole fuel in the transportation sector. As long as oil holds a monopoly on transportation fuel and most cars can run on nothing but oil, then there's no competition in the market, and no competition means that OPEC, as a collective, acts as a monopolist, not just in the global oil market, but much more importantly, in the global transportation fuel market. Fuel competition is absolutely critical to break this monopoly and lower prices at the pump. And with that, I'll be glad to take any questions later if you have them, but with that, I'll transfer over to Bruce Vollen, owner of Vollen Oil.
Great. Thanks, Ann. Ian, I'll just talk real simply here. It's as being a retailer, you know, what we're seeing in the last nearly 6 years as a blender, if you will, since we put our blender pumps in, is just an overwhelming response from the general population. You know, I don't go out there and hard sell any of this. I do answer some questions if they should arise, to tell people what they can do legally in their vehicles or not. And just give them the choice. It is so obvious to me what the consumers are after. And quite honestly, they want to buy more ethanol. You know, you want to talk about a blend wall, and I've said this a couple of times. I've tracked our gallons, you know, in the last year, just since the inception of having E15 as a legal fuel, after we had it, after we did our due diligence, I guess, to sell it as a legal fuel. It rapidly became our second best seller. I mean, essentially overnight, we went from selling E10, and our second best might have been NOLED or E30 and E15. Since the people knew about it, they demanded it, you know, and it saves them anywhere between 5 and 10 cents a gallon. You know, so with that said, that is what the consumer's after. They want to put in the blend that they choose, that they know is going to save them the most money, give them the most efficiency for the dollar. And right now, like Jeff was saying, you know, there's some blends that are a dollar a gallon cheaper. I'm here to tell you, I'm selling E85. I think it's $1.45 a gallon cheaper than regular unleaded. And of course there's some underlying factors, and that's obviously the cost of the RIN. And as a blender, you know, we collect these RINs and have the chance to resell them. And I so choose to pass most of the savings back onto the consumer. You know, it's such a great deal for everybody. And granted, that RIN can go away at any given time. It still doesn't change the fact that in the previous 5 years before RINs were even a factor, when they had a near zero value, at our station, people are still buying anywhere between that 18% and 28% ethanol. If you want to talk about the blend, well, that's exactly where mine's at. You know, in the weakest month throughout the course of the year, I sold 18% ethanol in a gallon of gas. The very best, probably these times would be similar to that too, you know, is up towards 28%. And that's, I guess that's about all I've got. Back to you there, Ann.
Hi, this is Anna Rath. I am the founder and CEO of Next Step, so representing a completely different perspective on all of this. We are a California-based, venture-backed startup company focused on developing the crops that will be the feedstocks for advanced and cellulosic biofuels. So the idea behind Next Step was you have this emerging and maturing set of industries around the world, biofuels, biopower, bio-based products. These industries have all gotten started on existing crops or wastes and residues, and that's great. That's exactly where they should have started because those things were available. They had existing supply chains. You could point to them and get the bankers to finance them. But as these industries continue to grow, if we want them to reach the level of scale and the level of sustainability that we all hope they will, you're going to need a set of crops, a set of feedstocks that was really designed for and optimized for these end uses. And so that's what we work on. We announced just this last April the launch of our first two product lines. The first is our Malibu Sweet Sorghums, which you can think of as basically sugar cane that comes from a seed and can be planted pretty much anywhere in the world. So just like sugar cane, you crush it, you get out this nice sugary juice, and you can take that and ferment it into your choice of bio-based products or advanced biofuels. Our other product line is our Palo Alto high biomass sorghums. Palo Alto translates roughly as tall stick, which is basically what we are trying to make this crop into. So it is a very high yielding crop that we have also bred to be dry at harvest. And that harvest is only about 120 days from planting. So in about 4 months, you can get this very high yield of dry biomass, which helps cut down on your transport costs and allows you to throw that feedstock directly into either a boiler for bioenergy or into a second generation or cellulosic ethanol process. We operate in two markets. Those are the U.S. and Brazil. Our sales in Brazil are strong and growing rapidly. Our sales in the U.S. are nascent, and this is why we are participants in Fuels America and on this call today, is because we believe that the big distinction between what's happening in Brazil and what's happening in the U.S. is that in Brazil they have very clear, well-defined, and favorable policy aimed at advanced and cellulosic biofuels, whereas in the U.S. what we have is, with all of the attacks on the RFS and some other issues, a lot of policy uncertainty, which makes it very difficult for people to make the kinds of large investments necessary to really build new infrastructure and begin producing these advanced and cellulosic fuels. So with that, I will turn the call back to Jeff Cooper to wrap things up.
Well, thanks very much, Anna. And I think at this time, operator, we will open it up for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Also, please ensure that you specify who to ask the question of during the Q&A session. First, we'll go to Mario Parker with Bloomberg News.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. I guess this question is for Jeff, but anyone can answer it. Wondering, RINs prices have gone up quite a bit. Is there any type of thresholds or ceiling for how high they can go? I mean, is it possible that we could see $2 RIN prices?
Well, thanks for the question, Mario. And I, yeah, certainly we've seen, you know, the Opus and Argus and Platts prices for RINs escalating here in the last week or so, and I think a lot of people in the industry are a little dumbstruck by why that's occurring. I think when you look at supply demand fundamentals, what you've seen is higher ethanol output in recent weeks. You've seen a stabilization in stocks, and so if anything, I would expect to see RIN prices trending lower as more physical gallons seem to be finding their way into the market. I mean, in fact, we saw refiners and blenders use more ethanol in the most recent weekly EIA report than they ever have in history. So I'm a little puzzled by what's going on there, and I think it underscores the fact that these RIN markets are very thinly traded. The prices that you see from Platts and Opus, it's hard to tell what those prices are actually representing. There may have only been a few trades done at those prices, and so that's what gets published that day. But I think what's important to remember is that the overwhelming majority of the RINs that are going to get turned in by refiners for compliance are being obtained with the gallons of ethanol that they're buying and blending. The demand, for RINs on the open market, the demand for detached RINs, remains pretty small, and so it's just not accurate to look at these prices being reported by Opus of $1.10 and expect that to represent the true value of RINs that we're seeing in the marketplace today.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Really appreciate it.